In the book of Revelation, chapter 5, there's an unusual picture that occurs. The picture is very simple, but it's unusual. John the Apostle is looking at a scene of what's going on in heaven. And he sees some scrolls that are sealed. And there doesn't seem to be anyone to open the scrolls. The scrolls, we're not told what significance they are until we find out that the Lamb on the throne, who seems to have been slain, is the way John portrays it, he has the right to open the scrolls. In fact, the whole rest of the book of Revelation is about opening those scrolls. We believe those represent the scrolls of history, the way God's history is going to proceed from that point on. And so it's the Lamb who has the right and responsibility to open the scrolls so that history goes on and that he's in control of them. We know from the book of Romans, chapter 8, verses 20 through 24, that was read this morning, that God's history is flowing toward a kind of restoration and renewal of all things. We can't always see it in our little view of history and our view of the world. Maybe we don't always see that happening, but the fact is, in the book of Revelation and in Romans, Paul is trying to give us a little bit of the big picture. History is going in a certain way. Revelation 21 and verse 5 reflects the same thing. God says there, "Behold, I am making all things new." Think about that. History is moving toward newness. And I know as we look at our little slice of history and a little slice of history as it's in our lives and as we read the papers and as we see what's going on, we don't necessarily see things being renewed. We see a lot of destruction. But somewhere behind all of that, God is seeking to renew all things. We know from John chapter 5 where Jesus tells us that there will be a resurrection of the righteous and the unrighteous. And of 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 10 through 13, that the world is headed toward, at some point, a day of judgment when God will make all things right, when he will set justice in order, and that he will, unfortunately, give to those who do not do righteousness, he will give them their due punishment. Those who have named his name and follow his son Jesus, the one who's in control of history, they will be rewarded for their deeds. We hope that more and more we'll see that. And that's the point of the church. That's the point of the witness of those of us who have believed it. God's history is basically a single drama played out in every nation. Listen to how Paul talks about it as he's giving a little lesson to these Athenian philosophers in Acts chapter 17 and verses 26 and 27. Speaking of God, the Apostle Paul says, "And he made from one nation every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he's actually not far from each one of us." And of course, Paul goes on to, I was going to say suggest, he doesn't just suggest it, he tells us that he has appointed his son Jesus Christ ultimately to be the judge, but ultimately to be the one that reveals himself to all mankind. That's what history is all about. For quite some time, there have been certain philosophers who have proposed that their way of life is sort of the inevitable flow of history. You hear it in Marxist philosophy, socialism, communism, some of those kinds of ways of thinking that simply want to insist that their way is the way, that the sort of what they're doing is sort of inevitable. And for those who may disagree with them, suggest today, especially as supposedly backwards Christians, we have to get on the right side of history. Because they're sort of echoing this idea that, well, we're on the right side of history and you guys are not. And they make us can feel pretty intimidated at times. And especially when you look at various trends going on. Anybody who disagrees with the trend, you know, is on the wrong side of history in their way of thinking. Simply want to say today, don't listen to them. They can no more tell the future than by flipping a coin and say, "Well, this is going. Let's see which one's going to happen. So we'll flip a coin." Simply is not going to be that way. The God side of history is the right side. And I think as we look at what Jesus is saying here, Jesus sort of previews a little bit of history for the disciples. And you know, he challenges their assumptions here. He challenges what they think are the way things are going to be. Now, they're good Jewish boys. They've been grown up with all the promise, or they've been grown up being taught all the promises of Israel, the fact that God is going to restore all things. And surely, as they look around at this temple area, which apparently was rather large and extensive, and according to them, quite beautiful, they looked at it and said, well, surely this is what's playing a role in God's salvation history. And Jesus takes them and says, well, let me give you a little insight here. It's not really going to work out that way. All the stuff you see, it's going to be gone. And, you know, he really challenges their way of thinking. Now, Jesus isn't challenging the fact that God is going to restore all things. He's challenging the fact that they're going to restore it in a way they think he's going to restore it. And so he tells them the temple is not a part of this. It's going to be gone. It's an unimportant piece of architecture. Now, let me take that back. It's not totally unimportant, but the architecture itself, the place, is not going to be so important at some point. And he goes on to describe them. He says, you guys better be careful, because there's people are going to be coming around at some point, and they're going to be saying to you, you know, I'm the guy that you're looking for. Well, just don't listen to them. They may even say something like, I am the inevitable flow of history. I don't know if they would have expressed it exactly that way, but you kind of get the idea. I'm the one you're looking for. And Jesus says, don't. Just a little sidebar here, based on the theology as I see it at this point. Jesus is not describing in all of Mark chapter 13 what I think is necessarily going to be happening in today's contemporary America, Israel, the world, whatever. I don't think he's describing that. I think he's describing what's going to happen to the temple in Jerusalem. Now, how much of that plays a role in our thinking today, that's for a later and perhaps larger discussion. But I'm not convinced that, well, people who say we're living in the last days, well, that's true. The fact is, we've been living in the last days since the first century. So the last days have kind of been with us since the time of Christ, since basically his resurrection and the gospel. That's the kind of climax of history. And there's still obviously something to come here. But the fact is, I don't think he's taking what's happening in the first century and say, well, all that's going to happen today as well. I don't know. Anyway, just to put it in perspective, okay? But I'd like to look at several groups of people, perhaps, who look at history and try to figure out what's going on, okay? And maybe look at God's side of history, or don't even see God's side of history, all right? So there's several sides we can fall down on when it comes to whether or not we're on the right side of history. The first one I simply call the rebel side, okay? That's those people who usually insist that everything they're doing is the right side. And when people accuse you of being on the wrong side of history, it's usually because they see current trends and insist all those current trends are going to last. Maybe it's the trends they want to last, and they think that this is the way society is going. And in some ways, they're right. The question is going to be, will those things last? I don't know about you, but I've never been a person that have really liked trends, even theological trends. You know, there are certain ways of thinking about theological things, God things, that I think can be very trendy. And they may kind of touch on a certain truth, but they don't give you the whole picture. Usually the insistence of these people who think that they're on the right side and you're on the wrong side is usually with rhetoric that sounds appealing. It can be spoken of in terms of justice, fairness, tolerance, freedom. There's all kinds of good things that people can put into this sense of history that they think is the right one. The problem is, more often than not, there's no place for God in it. It was not surprising to me a number of years ago, in fact, in 2012, when one of the conventions, one of the political parties' conventions, the delegates literally sought to expunge the name of God from anywhere in their platform, anywhere of their written statements. They wanted the name of God out. And it was only by somebody's decision higher up who said, no, we're not going to do that. But everybody wanted that. It was very interesting to me. I want you to think about one of the Psalms that addresses this whole notion of, well, let's do things without God. Psalm 2. Psalm 2 addresses those nations and those people who assume they can skirt God's plan for salvation or God's plan for the kingdom and God's plan for history. In verses 1 through 3 of Psalm 2, the psalmist suggests how many of these people, they sort of set their, they set themselves against God. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. This is a group of people, and apparently it's a pretty substantial group of people, who simply are saying, we don't want God. We're going to do it the way we see fit to do it. In verses 4 through 6, it's a very interesting reaction on God's part. You know what God does? He laughs. He laughs. I don't know if you ever think about God laughing, but this is a laugh that borders on mockery. As if God is saying, seriously? You think you can, stop me from putting my plan in motion? He who sits in heaven laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. And then in verse 6, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. God is going to do what God is going to do. No matter what the nations do, no matter what view of history people come up with, God's got a plan. And guess what? Isn't anybody going to stop him? And that's the point that he's trying to make. And in verses 10 through 12, he warns them. Be wise, O kings. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. So, for those who are on the rebel side of history, God sends out a warning to them. Those who prefer history without God, it's just not going to happen. It'll go along for a while. Think about the old Soviet Union. What happened to them? They had a platform that said God doesn't exist. That's our official way of seeing history. That's the thing we say, that's the way it's going to be, and we're going to enforce that. Well, where are they today? What did it last, 70 years maybe? And I know there's still some of the remnants of their philosophical ideas still floating around the world, but, they're gone. They're gone for the most part, at least as a Soviet Union. The rebel side, clearly, is the wrong side of history. You just can't run away, or you can't resist God for very long and get away with it. The second side of history, I'm going to call it either the runaway side or the resisting side. Okay, either one of those I think will work. Because what you have in this second group is people who kind of know that God is right, but they're sort of running away from it, or they're just resisting it. Okay. They don't necessarily deny that it's wrong, but they just sort of not really wanting to be a part of God's flow of history or salvation history. They kind of agree with God somewhat, but they don't want to kind of get into the flow of it fully. And I think there's a number of, shall we say, subgroups or a number of types of people in this. Maybe they don't disagree with God, but they just don't make a commitment to it. They just look at it and go, well, yeah, okay, it's pretty good, but I'm just kind of not there yet. Maybe they want to agree, but some unknown thing, maybe emotional trauma, maybe doubts, something is just kind of holding them back. Maybe they don't even know for sure, and maybe, if any of us have had discussions with people like that, we might not be able to put our finger on what it is. They just say, well, I'm just kind of not ready, or, something along those lines. Maybe they've even been brought up learning about God, but they've just fallen away from it. Maybe they're just too busy to join in. Any number of things can happen with people. The more I talk to people, the more I've grown older, I realize what Jeremiah said is true, the human heart is deceitful above all else. It's just dark. And there's just all kinds of things. You just can't always understand it. With or without trying, they're still just running away. Whether it's purposeful or whether it's just sort of something that's happening, they're still running away from it. They're kind of resisting it. A non-decision is still a decision. You don't make a decision for something, you're kind of making a decision. You're sort of standing still. But there's a blessing that God has displayed for us that's sometimes beyond even our understanding. God's process in all this is really very, very slow in some ways. And it is a blessing in disguise. In 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 4, Peter says something that's really pretty phenomenal that I think, knowing the nature of God, we all can kind of agree with. And that simply is, God's process is very slow. God is patient. There apparently are some people around Peter's day who are saying, well, it's been taking an awful long time. We've been waiting all this time. It's not happening. Why is that? Peter says, well, it's because you don't understand the nature of God. You really don't understand what God is doing. Peter defends the waiting and the slowness of the way things are going about as a reflection of God's patience. Look at verse 9 of 2 Peter chapter 3. The Lord is not slow to fulfill his promise, as some count slowness, but is patient toward you, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should reach repentance. Just when you think things are going along way too slowly, you got to realize God is purposeful about that. And he's purposeful about that because he's giving so many of us so much time to work through the things that maybe we struggle with. And it's one of the beauties of God's personality. God's character is that he is so patient in his kindness and in his compassion for us. He just kind of gently keeps nudging us on, you know, move a little here, move a little there, giving us time. Maybe giving us time to work through a lot of the things that we can't seem to always work through. I've read a speech this week, and I actually read the guy's book, a guy by the name of Mike Adams. He's a criminology professor at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Former atheist turned Christian. He's got an interesting story, not the least of which is now that he has tenure, they can't get rid of him, and they want to, because he's sort of like a thorn in their flesh. He keeps saying things about Christ and about God that they just, well, we don't want to hear that. Well, fire me. You can't. Anyway. His coming to Christ had some very interesting ways about it. Number one, being a criminology professor, he goes and he interviews prisoners. One of the prisoners he interviewed, and I don't want to say this in a politically incorrect way, but the guy was kind of not right in his head. He was sort of not all there. And I don't know how to say that to where it sounds nice, you know, but he just had some problems mentally. Let's say it that way. But somehow he knew enough to be able to spout John 3:16 to Mike. And over a period of months, he kept thinking about that. How does this guy know that? How does that mean anything to him? You know, who just doesn't, he seems to have a problem with his thinking in the first place. But it wore him down after a while. He had to really think through that. Then at some point, he encountered somebody himself. At the time, he was very pro-choice when it came to abortion. And he encountered somebody who was pro-life. And the person didn't try to argue with him, didn't try to push him too hard. But she made some comments to him that he looked at it later and he said, you know, it was kind of like putting a little piece of sand in my shoe. After a while, I couldn't ignore it. She didn't push it down my throat. She just put that little piece of sand in my shoe. And it got to be so annoying. I had to keep thinking about it. I couldn't stop thinking about it. And eventually he sort of worked through it, really thought it through, was honest enough to see these other sides of a way of life, and he's since become a Christian himself. He kind of stopped running away and got on the right side of history, is my point. And think about that with people. Think about yourself and how long maybe it took you. Maybe it didn't take you long, but for some, it does take them a little bit of time. Maybe you can be the one who puts a little piece of sand in somebody's shoe, or as you know, biblically speaking, we put a seed in their heart and see if it grows, and hopefully that it will grow. But of course, we also have to talk about those who are on the right side of history. The right side of history is those who believe that when we die, we will stand before the judgment seat of God. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 27. History is flowing to that day. Several times in the book of Hebrews, the writer talks about that day that's coming, that last day that's coming. We still believe that. No matter who scoffs at it, no matter what they think about it, that's still one of the teachings of the New Testament. History is flowing to a final conclusion. The right side of history are those who responded to Peter in Acts chapter 2 when he said to them, save yourselves from this corrupt generation, Acts chapter 2 and verse 40. They are the same people whom Peter wrote to later on and said that in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 9, the most important thing about your life is the salvation of your souls. That's priority number one. There just isn't anything more important than that. Being on the right side of history are those who believe that when they will meet Christ when he returns, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 17 paints a rather interesting picture, but he ends with the following statement. He says, then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so we will always be with the Lord. That's where history's headed. That's the right side. That's God's side of history. And it's the only side we really need to think about being on. The death, burial, and resurrection of Christ were definitive acts of history. Everything that God had done before that focused all his attention and all everybody's attention on that one act, even if they missed it at first. The climax of history will occur when he returns to take the righteous to be with him, but he will reject the unrighteous. That's a truth we have to live with. It's a truth that God has told us is a part of history. And my encouragement simply today, be faithful to the gospel of Christ and be faithful and realize that that is the right side of history. Don't let your confidence be shaken that somehow you're on the wrong side of history. You are not. God's side of history is the right side. You don't want to miss out on that, do you? I don't think any of us would answer that. Oh, yeah, I won't worry about that. But that's what we all want. And so be confident that you're on the right side. And I just simply like to offer an invitation to you this morning. What can we do to help you along the way? We've set aside a time that Wayne and I have kind of an elder's prayer, and you know, we offer some times for you to let us know what your needs are, and specifically, how can we help you stay on that right side? And so we want to encourage you this morning, utilize those cards in the back to ask for prayers or talk to us later. We have classes. We have so many things available to you to help you stay on that right side. That's what we want. And so we want to offer an invitation to you this morning. If you're not on the right side, get on the right side. Hear, believe, repent, confess, be baptized. I think most of us know the plan of salvation. But we want to help you along the way. And so we want to encourage you this morning to think about what side of history are you on and to get on the right side. Shall we do that now while we stand and sing?